We are keeping democracy alive.
Check for pulse. Stand clear. Push to shock.
So, yes, there's a huge gap between public opinion and public policy. That people don't feel that they can do very much.
You know what this is? This is a very Hamiltonian system. Alexander Hamilton being the guy here in a very un-Jeffersonian.
In the case of the Republicans, it's dramatically the opposite. But even in the case of the Democrats.
An absolute typhoon of terror against African Americans in the South.
America's fascists are those people who think that Wall Street comes first and the American people come second.
Really seen as a financial sector that's gotten out of hand.
The shooting, the violence, that is not the drug problem. That is, in fact, the drug policy problem.
I speak tonight for the dignity of man.
Snatching defeat from the jaws of victory, one might think doing that once might be enough. Going into the 2016 presidential election, no one doubted the Democratic nominee would fairly easily beat the incredibly unpopular and just plain ridiculous Republican nominee, Donald Trump. But we all know what happened. Now, generally, when a team loses a game they were expected to easily win, they lick their wounds and make sure they learn what they need to learn, what they did so amazingly wrong. It really did take a special kind of candidate and campaign to lose to Donald Trump. Today, all polls show that the most popular political figure in America is Bernie Sanders, the guy from whom the Democratic Party establishment was so fiercely determined to deny the nomination. Amazingly, to many traditional Democrats, liberals, who quite clearly prefer to actually win, Hillary Clinton refuses to go away, as does her team on Wall Street. In fact, it seems that that wing of the party remains determined to hold on to its power despite the obvious risks to any chances of victory in the upcoming 2018 and 2020 elections. Today on Keeping Democracy Alive, we're going to delve into the political dynamics still in charge of the top of the National Party establishment. What are the two wings of the party? And what is the corporate Clinton wing of the party so determined to accomplish? I'm pleased to have back on Keeping Democracy Live, Robert Borisaj. Thanks for being with us, Bob.
My pleasure.
Well, Bob Borisaj is a long-term progressive leader and writer, senior advisor of People's Action. He created a range of progressive organizations, including most recently the Campaign for America's Future, Progressive Majority, and ProgressiveCongress.org. He guided the Institute for Policy Studies for nearly a decade. He served as issues director for the Jesse Jackson 1988 presidential campaign. Boy, was that ahead of its time. And consulted on many progressive campaigns, including the late Senator Paul Wellstone, and most recently, Representative Jamie Raskin, a contributing editor to The Nation. Borisaj's articles have been published by Reuters, The Huffington Post, Progressive Breakfast, The Washington Post, and The New York Times. His current article, what we're going to talk about, is called Wall Street Has Some Advice for the Democratic Party, and Democrats Need to Ignore It. He writes, "The Wall Street wing of the Democratic Party will always be with us. Its policies on financial deregulation, trade, fiscal austerity, mass incarceration, and military intervention have been ruinous. Its political aversion to populist appeals has been self-defeating. But Wall Street has the money, so it will always enjoy upholstered think tanks," I like that description, "perches on op-ed pages and gaggles of politicians eager to peddle its proposals." Boy, that is a good description. When you say, Bob, it will always be with us, has the Wall Street wing really always been with us? My recollection is that our very identity has been that we are the solid, dependable, clear voice of working people. We were certainly not the party of Wall Street when FDR led the party. Tell us about this transformation. Was it in the 1990s? Am I right on that? When did they get so much power?
Well, I would say it started even earlier. You can argue that Carter was the first new Democrat. But in any case, you can trace it with the decline of the power of labor unions and the numbers of organized workers and the rise of inequality and financialization in the economy, which gave, you know, Wall Street salaries went from being not much dissimilar from regular corporate salaries to being outrageous and beyond belief. And as they gained more money, they gained more power.
That's fairly straightforward, I guess. What were the DLC? You know, I guess they're not around anymore. The Democratic Leadership Conference, was it? And what have they morphed into now? The Democratic Leadership Council, was it?
Yeah, Democratic Leadership Council. Jesse Jackson used to call them Democrats of the leisure class. That was a pretty good description. They were organized around what used to be a strong wing of Southern conservative Democratic politicians. Oh. Sam Nunn, Bill Clinton, Al Gore, etc. And their point was that Democrats had to abandon the old coalition and the old politics of the FDR coalition, that labor unions were outmoded, that the new economy was transforming America, and Democrats had to get with it. And they combined at the time a desire for Democrats to be, one, tougher on the military, tougher on national security questions, more interventionist, more military spending, two, more conservative on social issues, so on guns, on mass incarceration, on race. They wanted Democrats to back away from the liberal commitments of the Great Society, and then much more corporate on economics. So a combination of deregulation, embracing corporate trade policies, deregulating Wall Street, and that was essentially the frame that they thought would win elections.
Well,
they came to power. Bill Clinton was the chair of the DLC, but Clinton campaigned with a much more populist voice, which people forget. He issued a document called Putting People First. He called for raising taxes on the rich and spending tens of billions of dollars to rebuild America and promised universal health care, et cetera. And so while he did do the kind of race bait separation politics, frying Ricky Ray Rector, who was an African-American in Arkansas who had lost his mind, but Clinton was sentenced to death. Clinton flew back to Arkansas publicly to sign his death warrant, called for three strikes and you're out sentencing, the kind of opening the door to the mass incarceration that followed. While he did all that, he, on economics, ran with a much more populist message. But once he got into government, he named Bob Rubin from Goldman Sachs to be his economic advisor, and his policies turned much more into the corporate mode. So financial deregulation, austerity, he abandoned his spending proposals. He himself said, look, we look like we're passing a budget that's like a Dwight D. Eisenhower budget. Yeah, except it was Eisenhower without the roads. And so we, you know, what followed was NAFTA and the WTO and trade deficits unprecedented in the annals of times, deregulation of Wall Street, and what became, what led to the financial crisis and collapse, and and an austerity on domestic spending, to the point when the stock market boom had created surpluses, and Clinton, instead of using that money to start rebuilding a country desperately in need of it, argued for paying down the national debt, and in fact did that in his last couple of years.
Huh. Well, I have a couple questions coming out of what you were just describing. The strength of unions. Let's face it, it ain't what it used to be. The unions were big in the 50s and then just have continued to decline. Was that by shifting the party away from being so cozy with unions, was that not a you know, fairly pragmatic direction in which to go?
No, I would argue just the reverse. I think Democrats had a huge stake in finding ways to build unions, to protect unions, to make it easier for workers to organize and to bargain collectively. Republicans set out to destroy unions in every way they can. And to this day, every Republican elected official knows that one of their tasks is to try to weaken unions. And they wanted to do that, one, because unions were a pain in the neck of corporate executives who are their donors, and two, because they were a pillar of the Democratic Party. They organized and helped educate workers. They mobilized volunteers. They were vital to any party that could claim to have a more progressive economic agenda. Democrats, particularly with the advent of New Democrats, stopped being the defenders of unions, even as they were facing this fierce attack, and started being skeptical. Oh, these were, you know, turtles in the road. They're just going to get run over in the global economy. There's no reason to defend them, etc. And the result was that unions, in fact, grew weaker and weaker, other than the public employee unions, and they're under attack now. Without a party to defend them and without the political changes in the law that would have made it easier for workers to organize.
Well, my other question is, was it a case of, well, if you can't beat them, join them? I mean, because it sounds like the direction in which the Democratic Party went was where the Republican Party already was. And if people, I don't know who originally said this, but if people are given a choice between real Republicans and imitation Republicans, they're going to choose the real thing all the time. So I don't understand that strategically.
Well, I think strategically, in terms of the unions, it was a really profound mistake. You know, we had labor law reform under Clinton failed in the Senate by one vote. Clinton couldn't produce the vote of an Arkansas senator. Clinton, of course, was from Arkansas, which was ridiculous. Under Obama, there was another move for labor law reform. SEIU and others had been instrumental in his upset victory over Hillary Clinton in the primaries and driving him to the election. And yet, once he was in the White House, he basically said to the unions, you find the votes, and if you round them up, I'll sign the legislation, and put no kind of political capital into getting the law passed, and it again failed by a very small margin. And so this kind of neglect has helped Republicans really destroy a central pillar of our small d democracy and a central pillar of the capital D Democratic Party.
Does seem to be the case, and it seems to be fairly obvious. We did lose. We were expected to win in 2016, and it just amazes me how those people that clearly made us lose still want to keep in power. If you just tuned in to Keeping Democracy Live, Bert Cohen here, our guest today, Robert Borisage, who has a new article called Wall Street Has Some Advice for the Democratic Party and Democrats Need to Ignore. We were talking about the DLC. Your article speaks of Will Marshall. I had never heard of him. Who is he, and what two legislative victories does he point to of President Clinton, of which he is most proud?
Well, Will was the co-founder of the DLC. He became the director of its Progressive Policy Institute. And then when it went under, he now recently has created a new organization that's called the New Democracy, and raised a ton of money from the normal sources in order to what he calls develop, quote, really big ideas for Democrats. But this is one of them. You know, once the DLC went down, there was a whole range of these institutions founded by New Democrats. So there's the Third Way, right, which claims it has a $20 million program to investigate the white working class that voted for Trump and find out how to talk to them without alienating bankers. And then there's kind of visible commentators like Doug Schoen, who appears on Fox News as a Democrat. And Schoen is was an advisor to Clinton, and he's the one who wrote in the Wall Street Journal that the Clinton presidency should be a model for modern day Democrats, and particularly with two key legislative economic victories, the Telecommunications Act and the Financial Services Modernization Act. Mm. The latter repealed Glass-Steagall and helped make way for the financial bubble and collapse, and the former, the Telecommunications Act, is the reason we wasted trillions of dollars in speculative ventures and ended up with slower broadband and higher prices than any European country.
Uh-huh. So he's proud of them. That is so antithetical to the Democratic Party in which I grew up. I do find it rather bold of the Wall Street wing of the Democratic Party. I even have a hard time considering them as a wing of the Democratic Party. However, when they argue that Democrats lost in 2016 because we had lurched too far to the left, I don't even understand that argument. Help me, please.
Well, I think that's a joke. I think Schoen is sort of a minstrel, and almost his article belongs in the Onion, not on the pages of the New York Times or the Washington Post. I don't think any sensible people think that Hillary lurched to the left and lost the election because of that. They are fearful of and organized to stop is any kind of a populist agenda such as that professed by Sanders. So they're all up in arms against the move to make Medicare for All a centerpiece of the Democratic agenda going forward. They're up in arms against the questioning of our kind of ruinous corporate trade policies. And they are big-time advocates, as you could imagine, people funded by Wall Street would be, of balanced budgets and austerity, even to the point of, kind of going after Social Security and Medicare. So, and they would like to find a way to make that popular for working people, and to argue that it is popular for working people. And they have a very hard time doing that. The argument comes, Steve Rattner had a piece in the New York Times recently, the argument comes down to really we ought to be for retraining and for greater mobility so that people can take their 401ks and move to a new employer. All the things which assume that we'll continue this process of allowing corporations to ship jobs abroad and destroy communities here at home. And they think somehow we can sell that to people. I think the Trump victory ought to inform people that this stuff not only is disastrous in terms of its policy effects, but it's disastrous politically and can no longer be sustained. But that's the fight we're having now. And what you see, I think, in the Democratic Party is hopeful now. I think Schumer, who certainly is the New York senator from, kind of previously said from Wall Street, has become, as the leader of the Democrats in the Senate, much more open to the populist wing of the party. He brought Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders into the Democratic leadership to help sculpt message and agenda. He's kept the Senate, as Pelosi has the House, remarkably unified against the Trump, the ravages of the Trump agenda. It was stunning to me that all Democratic members of the House voted against the budget resolution that laid out the basis for tax cuts the other day. That shows real change, a sea change in some ways in the party as the populist wing gets more powerful and people understand, politicians understand increasingly that they have to respond to it. So, Cory Booker and Kamala Harris, who are two senators who have been heroes of the financial community, endorsed Medicare for All. And that was a real sign about the power of this agenda and their sense that this is where Democrats are. They better get over and start appealing to them.
Well, I wonder. I mean, you brought up how Bill Clinton and his campaign talked a bit of populist stuff, but then you know, move to the right. I wonder how much of this might be just window dressing. I mean, let's face it, the Democratic senators who, many of which did, whom did sign on to Bernie Sanders' Medicare for All, they know it's not going to pass. So isn't it a bit of window dressing, you know, speaking out of both sides of their mouth like Bill Clinton did?
Well, it could be. But I think that's whether it becomes it's window dressing or it becomes a change in where the window is really up to the movement continuing to build. And if the movement continues to build, it will be harder and harder to resist. I think on the right, Republicans are discovering that. The establishment Republicans are discovering that. They kind of played on race-based politics and anti-immigrant politics, and, et cetera, for years, and now they discover that their party has been transformed and is much more extreme than they are. And I think progressives, if we keep building a progressive populist movement out in the country, politicians who may now think that of this as just window dressing may become more and more staunch advocates. Roosevelt's New Deal have a lot more to do with the mobilization of workers and the left than it had to do with what Roosevelt believed when he first came into office.
That's true. They do tend to put their finger to the wind, and if it's clearly blowing one way, golly gee, they're going to go along with that way. And, you know, you talk about, you know, the middle of the country, and that's where, I mean, if you look historically where the populists have come from, it has been farmers, the old Democrat Farm Labor Coalition, the people, working people, you know, who have participated and have gotten it and put the pressure on so that they made it impossible for the politicians to ignore. Can the Democratic Party be both? Can it be for the working people and Wall Street? It seems like at least some are trying to do that. Or does it have to be one or the other?
Well, I think the question is, I think socially, it's like the Republican divide. Trump appeals to working people, particularly with his nativist, racist kinds of appeals, and he gives their establishment, their business community, a conservative economic agenda. Now, there's a real tension in that, but that's what he's been able to sell thus far. On the Democratic side, a lot of Wall Street people are socially liberal, and Democrats represent the best of social liberalism and diversity in an America that offers equal opportunity. And that's much more appealing to than the race-based divisive politics of the right. Mm-hmm. And on the other hand, the question is if our economics is populist, is designed to make the society work for working people, do they get off the bus or do they accept that as necessary in these days and stay aligned with the party? That remains to be seen, but I think that's the question.
Yeah, that's a pretty big one. And we've used the term populists a number of times, so maybe we need to define that term. It's been around a long time. Trump got elected as a populist. I wonder if we could define populism as it applies to left and right. You made it pretty clear on the right, you know, it's kind of racist, anti-immigrant, nativist. Where and when has left-leaning populism been successful, or have Democrats simply surrendered populism to the far right?
Well, the basic populist analysis is that there is a small elite that is rigging the rules for themselves and not serving you.
That's a good discussion.
The populism on the right is that small elite is a kind of limousine liberal elite that's using government to help those people, the poor or the minorities. The immigrants, and that's why you're getting screwed. The populism of the left, which is there's an elite that has rigged the rules to serve themselves, and that's the wealthy and the
already powerful
Wall Street and the corporations, and we have to take government back to make it our tool. The other theme about populism, particularly on the left, is that
it is not anti-government. It is, it understands that you have to take control of government in order to make it your tool so that you can build a society that works for working people.
Mm-hmm.
Now, has that ever been successful? I'd argue that Roosevelt shows that success. I would argue that it kind of politically resonates immensely with Americans. And you can see it in senatorial races like Sherrod Brown, who wins Ohio that Hillary lost badly. And Brown wins it with a populist argument where he talks to working people about who's rigging the rules against them and what that means. And I think you're going to see more and more politicians in that mode.
It's been surprising to me how many Democrats are afraid of that when it so obviously connects. I mean, as we said in the beginning, the most popular politician these days is Bernie Sanders. And could you get more populist in message? I seriously doubt it. I mean, he is right there talking to it, and people admire that bravery, that courage. And as I, you know, that thing about can Wall Street and the working people both be served? I'm conservative enough to think that, you know, in America, yeah, it's okay. People can get wealthy, and they can be relatively liberal too, and recognize that what's a good investment in terms of lifting up the public can also be, people can still get wealthy from that. It's just good for the economy and good for strengthening the nation's security somehow. You know, I mean, other countries, it's like you're either left, you know, real socialist or right, you know, total capitalist. But I think, you know, there's still, that is what the Democratic Party is. And what about people who say, well, Bernie Sanders is a socialist. I've heard this so much. He's not even a real Democrat. He'd never put the D beside his name on the ballot. What's your response to that? I think that's an interesting discussion.
Well, I mean, the point is, what's going to build not just a victorious electoral coalition, but a victorious coalition that allows you to make the changes necessary to make this society a more equal society of opportunity again, and to rebuild the middle class. And there's no question that it's not a question about whether you have a D at the end of your name or not. It's what's the agenda and the narrative and the coalition that you're going to build to be able to make the changes we desperately need. And if you win an election and you don't build the coalition, if Hillary had won this last election, which everyone, including myself, expected her to do.
Sure did.
She would not have built that coalition, and in fact, she would have done, needless to say, much better than Trump's doing. She wouldn't have been able to get much done at all, and she would have ended up with, you know, an angry and disappointed population looking for change. And so I just think we're in a period where it's not simply a question of, can I piece together the numbers to win an election? It is, can I lay out an agenda and a narrative and build a coalition that will actually allow me to make this thing work again, or at least make it work better than it is now?
Well, I'd say so. And again, if you just tuned in, Bert Cohen here. We're on Keeping Democracy Alive. Our guest today is Robert Borisage, who's written an article, longtime progressive voice, written an article called Wall Street Has Some Advice for the Democratic Party and Democrats Need to Ignore It. Well, what advice are they giving right now, specifically? And you know, Doug Schoen wrote an article, an op-ed in the New York Times called Why Democrats Need Wall Street. What advice are they giving that it would seem fairly obvious that should be ignored?
Well, I think their themes are quite clear, which is defend our corporate trade system. Don't fall for the populist critique of it. Don't go for Medicare for all or any big social programs that are too expensive. We can't afford them. Be responsible about small changes that are possible. Don't promise things that seem too bold. and for certain be more concerned about fiscal austerity and balancing our budgets than you are about hunger or poverty or education and the fact that you have to go into debt to get an education in the society.
Well, wouldn't they say that, well, you know, those people who, again, those people who don't have money, who are, you know, kind of left out of the economy, they don't vote. They don't vote. So what we need to do is go for the center. What is this center? Is there a real center? Are there is there polling data that shows there is something called the center that, you know, Democrats need to stay away from lurching to the left and go for the center? We can't win without the center. I've heard that for decades. What do you think about that, Robert?
Well, I think that was the theory of the Clinton campaign, was that you could appeal to different constituencies kind of with a kind of targeted agenda, and that you could stay away from a bolder, more populist language, and that you shouldn't overpromise, and that you shouldn't try to lay out a different direction for the country, that America was already great and just needed a little bit of improvement. Mm. And I think Hillary herself, in her book, when she looked back on the election, admitted at the end of the book that that was a mistake, that America, in fact, is looking for big ideas, and that she had misread the electorate, and that was contributed to the defeat.
And I wonder about the appeal for bold. Many years ago, there was a local minister who said, you know, that there's only two things in politics that work: reassurance, and that every year either people want more of the same or change. And I don't know how the Hillary people somehow looked at this year and saw that people wanted more of the same. I mean, you couldn't get more of the same candidate than Hillary Clinton. And the question is, what about the appeal of the bold? The Hillary wing, the Wall Street wing, is very, very fearful of the bold. But haven't we seen, I mean, it's just so evident that people want boldness. Whatever appeal Trump has, he's bold. And I can't help but think that, you know, people didn't really pay attention to what he was saying or doing, but they knew he was bold, and he talked about winning. And I wonder about the appeal of the bold and how the Wall Street wing of the party deals with that. Do they just not want to see that? I don't understand.
Well, I think this is, you know, you have to remember Trump's victory was a great surprise. He was an idiosyncratic voice in the Republican Party. And you know, the Hillary argument, the Hillary Obama argument, that the Democrats under Obama had saved the economy that was in free fall, which is certainly true, and that we'd had all these months of consecutive growth, and unemployment was down, and things were getting better, and yes, there were things to be done, but we have to stay the course. Essentially, that was seen as a very convincing argument. It was very hard for those of us who were arguing that you had to be a candidate for change, it was very hard for us to be heard because that was seen as such a powerful position. The other thing to be fair to Hillary is it would have been, as Obama's Secretary of State and as Bill Clinton's spouse, it would have been very hard for her to paint herself. She would really have to have made real excursions to put herself forward as a candidate of change. And she would have had trouble with whether people would believe her when she did that.
That's true.
But my own argument was she didn't, you know, she had to do that. She had to find a way to do that. That was her task. And I think she didn't really believe that until it was too late.
Oh, my goodness. And within the Democratic Party, I mean, there's various levers of power. I wonder if we could talk about the power, the access to the levers of power that Wall Street has versus the rest of us within, you know, the national leadership, in particular the Democratic Party? What are their, what is their specific access to power that they have compared to the rest of us?
Well, this is, you know, this is really easy. If you're a politician, you spend 2 or 3 hours a day calling people to raise money for re-election.
At least.
And the people you call are wealthy. That's who you talk to. And you talk to them personally. And when they call, you return their calls. And they get through to the congressman or the senator. So they have instant access. They have people who want to please them and get their money. They have their views are constantly aired formally and informally, privately and publicly with the legislators that they deal with. That is an immense advantage. You know, Obama wrote about it in one of his memoirs about how running for Senate, you keep talking to these people and they're good people and they're smart and they're attractive and they're successful. And eventually, you know, their views seem more and more reasonable, and you find yourself repeating them and increasingly adopting them. And I think that is the ultimate and kind of profound source of the power. We have a political system that is utterly perverted by big money, and that gives Wall Street an enormous, that's why that wing will always be with us.
And, but just, I mean, what money is about is, you know, spending the money on a campaign to win the votes, which means numbers of people. And, you know, I mean, you can, the Hillary ads on TV were all about how, you know, bad Donald Trump was, but it didn't really connect with people, I don't think. So all that money, you know, you still have to win the votes. And I think Bernie understood that. And the DLC Clinton Democrats argue that, I mean, to be competitive, Democratic candidates need to be competitive in terms of campaign cash, which is clearly true. And as we know, Wall Street is where the money is. Hillary raised a ton of money in small house parties from those interests, very traditional. Of course, there's the Bernie $27 phenomenon, where his average contribution was $27. I'm sure that must have shocked the heck out of the establishment on that. I wonder if you could refresh listeners' memories on this and tell us if you think that was a fluke, or can that, I mean, he raised a ton of money from very small contributions from a whole bunch of people. Can Democrats be competitive without the big bucks from the few people? Is it replicable?
An honest answer to that question is we don't know yet. Bernie, it's important to remember, Bernie shocked everybody, not just the establishment. He shocked the anti-establishment by how well he did and how much dough he was able to raise.
Yeah.
And it is true that other candidates, like Elizabeth Warren, who's a real champion for people and a scourge of Wall Street, has been able to fund her campaigns both with small and with large donations. And Sherrod Brown has been able to run populist campaigns, even though he opposes our kind of ruinous trade policies, and raise money to be competitive in a state like Ohio. So it's possible that we're slowly building the basis for candidates to be more independent of the moneyed interests. Uh-huh. But the way politics is done, the easy way to raise money comparatively, and the way the DCCC and the DSCC and all the party committees tell you to raise money is to get on the phone and call people who are people of means.
Yes.
And so it takes either enormous grit or courage or kind of a sense that you're an outsider like Bernie and you don't give a damn to try to go a different route. What Bernie has done is show that route may be enough, that the authenticity, the integrity, the credibility that comes from running that kind of a funding your campaign in that small donor way can in fact be a real boon to your campaign. And I think you'll see it as our revolution and the groups that have come out of the Sanders campaign start to field challengers across the country, you'll see more and more experiments about whether that will tell us whether it's possible, in fact, to be competitive in this modern world
without the big money.
You know, without big money, eventually we've got to change the system. It's perverse, and we've got to have reforms that make this thing not dependent on money, with matching funds or with the whole range of limits on that are sensible. But that's a reform agenda that's going to take that's starting, but it's going to take a lot of work. And until we get that, we've got to show that it's in fact possible to run with small donor-funded campaigns. And what Bernie has shown is that that's more possible than anyone thought.
Yeah, and it is about the whole campaign finance reform thing has been going on for decades, and it probably will still go on. And I mean, my sense is that wherever there's a demand for the money, like TV, there's going to be a supply. It just, that's just the way it works. But I don't hear much. I mean, this is a side issue. Talk about demand, limiting demand, having TV stations perhaps be required to provide free, equal airtime. But that's a long way off, and the main beneficiary of campaign dollars clearly has been the TV networks and the producers, the consultants, you probably know my friend Raymond Buckley, who's chair of the New Hampshire Democratic Party, and I want to talk a little bit more about what he experienced recently. He argues that all research proves that ground forces, people talking one-on-one with the other, are far more effective than big bucks TV. So I wonder if that dynamic alone can weaken the Wall Street wing's argument that, spending a zillion dollars on TV doesn't always work, but there's another way to do it. But maybe, I don't know if that reality is getting through to the consultants and stuff. I mean, of course, they want to make as much money as they can, and they are.
Yeah, the consultant racket is part of this, to be sure, and there hasn't been, at the Democratic Party level, any dramatic change in those consultants, so yeah. It's sort of business as usual. But it's also the case that it's a lot harder than people think to do a grassroots mobilization, enough of one to make an imprint. Now with social media, there's a bigger chance of doing that. And, of course, with a movement in the streets, with people increasingly part of a mobilized movement, there's an even greater chance of doing that. And that's what's important.
And there are those millions of millennials. I don't think anybody, least of which Bernie, was expecting them to have such passion for the Bernie side. The Hillary wing clearly doesn't connect with the millennials at all. But these people are the future. There's millions of them, and they had tremendous power. The DNC leadership, they're in it to win it. They want to win. How can they argue that staying the failed course is the way to go for 2018 and 2020 if they're obviously not connecting with the millennials? Do they just ignore that?
I think the general feeling, I think there's a strong argument that they make, which I don't agree with, but which is Trump is so extreme and the Republican Congress so extreme and haven't done anything, and what they've done has been terrible, that we can run an anti-Trump, anti-Republican failed Congress argument and win.
And big mistake.
And that certainly, you can get polling that shows that people hate Trump. They hate the Republican Congress even more. You can have polls that show people are, when you push on Medicare for All, people get nervous about it. And so you have to debate it. It's not just a slam dunk, and big ideas always make people nervous. You can see the kind of polling and moneyed interests and establishment interests that say, look, we don't need to go down this road. We can win simply because they're so extreme.
I don't buy it.
And I actually think it's plausible that they could win because they're so extreme.
The problem is you can't change anything, even if you win, under those conditions. And in fact, what we need is to keep building a movement and an argument and an agenda that rallies people that can get a mandate to actually get real change done. And that's not engaging in that is simply, making sure that we have a different party rather than a different course heading our nation.
Interesting. And I remember in 2004 when, who was John Kerry? Well, he was not Bush, but, and you know what? He didn't win. We have to have, in my opinion, our own.
Well, he may have won. He may have run.
Well, that's true.
But in any case.
He didn't become president, that's for sure.
Right.
And as I mentioned before, Ray Buckley is a good old friend of mine. He's chair of the New Hampshire Democratic Party, who ran unsuccessfully to become chair of the DNC. And he was part of a recent purge. And he was genuinely neutral between Hillary and Bernie in 2016. He really was. Ray Buckley had been on the Rules Committee and just recently was a victim of what some call a push, you know, a purge. The members were swept out by Chairman Tom Perez. Is that just inside baseball or what is the significance of that? It seems I get the sense that that doesn't bode well for the Democratic Party and for connecting with our old traditional Democratic base.
Well, who heads the DNC and who's on the DNC has always been the most inside of baseball, but it's changing now because you have the Sanders challenge and then Keith Ellison running,
right,
who had supported Sanders, running to head the party, and the odds-on favorite to win until the Obama-Clinton forces came in and got Perez to run and put lots of resources behind him. Now it's Perez's job. He won the race. It's Perez's job to figure out how to unify the party and to make it, to get it to understand what went wrong, not just with Hillary, but with 1,000 legislative seats across the country and both the House and the Senate going Republican, and what we do differently. And I think he made Keith his deputy chair, and he did a unity tour with Sanders. But internally, the old he's basically sustained the grip of the more conservative wing of the party and the more conservative forces in the party. And we haven't seen either in terms of a change in strategy or in consultants or in message or in reaching out and engaging the Sanders people. We haven't seen the kinds of steps that would have to be made to get this party more unified. What unifies Democrats now is Trump. And internally there's a large argument about where the Democratic Party ought to go. And I think that's a good thing. We need to have that big argument and we need to have a big fight about what Democrats represent and what their agenda is, and so that's going on.
Yeah, I agree. It's a good thing. What is our identity? I mean, it's been clear for many years what the Republican Party identity was, and then it's something else now with Trump. That's not completely new, but it's a process of history finally bringing this, you know, nativist, racist stuff that's always kind of been there under the surface. Now it's to the surface. But we still need an identity. People need to see who the heck the Democrats are. And I don't see that happening with the Perez, Wall Street, Hillary people leading it. In fact, one of the big concerns of a lot of people in 2016 was the superdelegates. You know, and that's really kind of undemocratic with a small d. The 2018 superdelegates to the Democratic National Convention will include lobbyists for Rupert Murdoch's News Corp, Citgo Petroleum, Citigroup, and other large corporations. It's looking like the role of the superdelegates is locked into place. What are your thoughts about this and how important that is and meaningful?
Well, there's a unity commission that came out of the National Convention that includes both Clinton supporters, Sanders supporters, and Perez appointees. They've been meeting. One of the things on their agenda is
how many votes will be given to superdelegates.
Right.
I think, and whether they should vote at all, I think they will undoubtedly come out with a recommendation that dramatically reduces the weight of superdelegates in the next presidential election. And we'll see if the DNC adopts that or not. That comes to a head, I think, at the end of this year.
Boy, I hope so. And there was a move to require the superdelegates to reflect the will of the people. That did not happen in 2016. And I think it hurt the Democrats' chances in 2016. I wonder, do you hear anything? Your ears are closer to the movement than mine, to require, to have a rule that superdelegates reflect the will of the people. I mean, Bernie Sanders won this state, New Hampshire, by 22 points. And yet, I believe the delegate count in the final analysis was about 50-50.
I don't know the best answer, but my sense is that that demand has been rejected.
That's too bad. Once again, we're so good at claiming defeat from the jaws of victory. Democrats have a long tradition, no doubt. You've heard the phrase from Will Rogers: "I'm not a member of any organized party. I'm a Democrat." That just goes on and on and on. And again, if you just tuned in, Bert Cohen here. We're on Keeping Democracy Alive, which is a group effort, folks. You got to get involved in that. Our guest today is Robert Borisage, and we're talking about the Wall Street wing of the party having advice for the Democratic Party, and our guest says Democrats need to ignore it. What about, we've all heard people saying it's a mistake for the party to go left, that we can be painted as, socialists, which actually I find that word socialism, according to anything I've read, the millennials aren't scared of that word. It used to be that you say the word socialist and people stop thinking, that in order to win elections, we have to appeal to the center. What about this idea of going left, like openly welcoming it, just going for the traditional wing of the party? Can we win by...
I think the problem with that whole argument is that there's kind of an assumption in the framing of the question that if you go left, you're going with a minority. The center of the country, the vast majority of the country, supports defending Social Security. It supports expanding Medicare. It supports Medicare for all.
Yes.
It supports tuition-free college.
Yes.
It supports a $15 minimum wage. The center, where people are in the majority or the large plurality of Americans is in a very different place than the traditional agenda of either party. So it won't, if we do a more populist economic agenda, it won't be moving to the left so much as it will be moving to the center of American opinion.
Oh, interesting. I think that's a very interesting point. And another issue that I've cared about a lot is rebuilding infrastructure, which Roosevelt did so effectively. And even the Trump people found that during their 2016 campaign, that rebuilding the infrastructure was very, very popular, probably more than anything else. And Democrats are afraid to touch it. I don't know why, but it resonates with people.
Well, I think that's a consensus. That's a consensus among Democrats now that it's time to rebuild our infrastructure. Hillary embraced it. Sanders obviously championed it. Schumer and Pelosi have made it a centerpiece of their agenda.
No, I hope we do it.
It's stunning to me that Trump hasn't done it. One of the things about this tax cut that Republicans are about to try to cram through the Congress is that it will make it virtually impossible to rebuild the country. And the choice between giving a lot more money to people who already have billions and instead using the money to actually put people to work rebuilding the country in areas that we desperately need, from water systems to roads to railroads, et cetera, is a stunning historic turn that we're about to make. That argument has to be made clear to people that this is what they're doing. They're really cashing in our future, and we're going to have an economy that has an infrastructure that is not competitive, that costs enormous amounts of money, but worse, is even dangerous to people's lives.
Yes.
Pipes fail, sewer systems, bridges, water systems fail.
Yeah.
Because we're simply not spending enough money to modernize. And instead we're going to give that money to people who already have billions, which is just makes no sense whatsoever.
Well, my sense is that at the local and state level, despite what's going on at the top of the DNC, traditional Democrats are making, in fact, great gains, through long, slow, dedicated involvement, and are indeed having success at winning local and state elections for progressive populists. Can change in the Democratic Party effectively come from the bottom up, or is that just naive?
It's the only way it does come. It's from the bottom up, so it damn well better.
Oh my goodness! Well, here we are. You know, just the 2018 elections are just starting up, and I think the Republicans have got to be sensing that they're just a tad vulnerable with this maniac in the White House. How optimistic are you feeling, Robert Borisage?
I still think it's harder than people think.
Yes, I agree.
I think Trump has an argument that he is doing what his voters sent him to do. He's disrupting the place. He constantly points to his trade policies, which is trying to change the trade policies that have been so ruinous. He's done the race bait stuff with the immigrants and Charlottesville. And so I think he's at under 40% in the polls, but that 40% is his 40%.
Solid.
I think the question is for Democrats is, does the mobilization of resistance, which has been impressive against Trump, does that stay mobilized and come out in state and local and congressional races without a national race? And are Democrats driving a narrative and an agenda that that mobilizes people, that gets people who too often don't vote by elections? We have a huge drop off of millennials, of single women, of minorities in non-presidential years. Is there, between the resistance and the positive agenda that Democrats are putting forward, is there enough to get people who generally are not interested out to vote?
Can we connect?
Question.
Can we plug in that energy? Will people in the resistance see that the Democratic Party is part of that? Well, this has been very, very interesting and revelatory. If people want to follow your work, what's the best website to which you can direct them?
You can go to... I think it's still working, www.rfuture.org.
I think so.
Or to peoplesaction.org. And either one will have
Our Future,
my stuff up there.
People's Action, Robert Borisage. Thank you so much for being with us on Keeping Democracy Alive. Look forward to speaking to you again. Thank you.
Be of cheer. Take care.